And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we await the results from the New Hampshire primary, everybody's talking about change. Obama framed it, Clinton stepped in, Huckabee can't help but be, Ron Paul has been for years, and Mitt Romney tried it on like a new glove. It's a good thing, change, because we need a new course. Change is being felt in many sectors, and a most encouraging area is within the faith-based communities. Today, we talk with someone who is working to inspire and implement change in the relationship that people of faith have with God's creation. That, and the Archbishop of Canterbury addresses the Bali Conference when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
2008 promises to be a year of change, and not a bit too soon. And I get the sense that this time, the desire for change will prevail into a new direction. But time will tell. Today we're going to hear from two advocates from the faith-based community. We open with a message from the Archbishop of Canterbury to the Bali Conference on Climate Change. We bring you his message during the weekly Earth Summit, which will begin in just a moment. In segment two, we head on over to the nation's capital, where Ben Campbell directs the faith-based initiative for Conservation International, which works around the world to restore and develop sustainable systems in some of the Earth's most critical concentrations of concern. Let's kick off this new year with a special message from the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and each week we meet here to hear recent speeches, reports, and commentary from around the world on the future of life on Earth. Today we feature a message from Archbishop Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who gave this message to the recent Bali Climate Conference. So now, the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Greetings to all the delegates meeting in Bali, and especially to members of local Christian churches. It's a great privilege to be able to address you on this occasion, this very significant occasion, in our thinking and planning about the future of this planet. People sometimes ask why religious communities should be interested in issues around climate change and the environment. And I want to begin by saying a few words about the very character of Christian ethics and morality itself. For Christians, what's good is the kind of action that allows the style and nature of God's own being, God's own activity, to come through. And God, we're told, looks at the world and sees it as good. He doesn't see it as something that is useful for him. He sees it as something to rejoice in. And when human beings are able to relate to their material environment in that way, they are echoing the way in which God himself relates to creation. The more we see the created order simply in relation to our own wants, our own needs, let alone our own greed and acquisitiveness, the further away we are from God. And that's why in the Christian Church, the sacraments show us a material world used by and for God. The things of this world used as signs of love, not as signs of power, as signs of control, as signs of separation. In thinking about any environmental issue, then, from a Christian point of view, we'll be looking for those kinds of activity that reflect the nature of God, that reflect that possibility of a joyful appreciation of nature for what it is. But that, of course, is only part of the story. Christian ethics is also fundamentally about justice. It's about the way in which the love and the mercy of God, the gift of God, is spread abroad for all to share. And those kinds of actions which accumulate, which hoard up bits of the world so as to protect us from one another as human beings, those kinds of activity which privilege the interests of one group over another, those are the activities that God judges. So what we have to ask in our present situation is, what are those actions that God's justice passes sentence upon? Now, when we begin to think about the justice of God and how we are to do justice in relationship to our environment, two major considerations come up at once. The first is that the justice of God is a timeless thing. God is not more interested in the past than in the future, not more interested in the future than in the present. God's love and gift is there for all. And that means that it's possible for us to act unjustly in relation to future generations, to privilege our own interests and concerns over those of our children and grandchildren. The crisis that is threatened by climate change at the moment is a crisis of that kind. We are being shown, more clearly perhaps than we could have imagined 10 or 20 years ago, we are being shown how easy it is to be unjust, unfair to our children and grandchildren. To adopt an attitude and a policy towards our material world at this present moment, which in effect says, what really matters is what we need now, and not at all what is needed by future generations. We are depriving our children and our grandchildren of a world, and that is nothing if not unjust. So in that very broad and general way, we can talk about climate change as an issue that impels us to think about God's justice and how we are to echo it in our world. You're meeting in a part of the world where this is no academic issue, where rising water levels are already threatening livelihoods and lives themselves. We're looking at a future in 10, 20 years where this issue of rising water levels will more and more be a question of survival in many of the poorer areas of the world. In relation to that, though, there's yet another question about how the policies we adopt in order to control and limit the evil effects of climate change themselves can be seen as bearing most heavily on those least able to deal with them. How, in fact, they can be part of a continuing spiral driving people downwards further into poverty. The biggest challenge that faces us in terms of global policy at the moment is how we are to find ways of reducing and controlling climate change without eating into the economic aspirations, the proper aspirations of our poorer societies towards prosperity, respect, and dignity. The whole issue of how we approach carbon trading, the set of issues around contraction and convergence and agendas like that, these are issues that have to be thought through very carefully in terms of how the results of policies seeking to control climate change can at the same time work for the good, for the benefit of the neediest of our societies. It's a complex challenge, admittedly, but it's one that urgently needs addressing if we're not to face a continuing future of deep suspicion between societies in our world, between the less prosperous and the more prosperous. If we're to avoid the accusation, sadly well-founded at times, that climate change and related environmental issues are a luxury for the wealthier nations to be preoccupied about, while they fail to address the urgent questions of economic development for the poor. Those gathered at Bali, and especially those who gather with strong ethical and religious commitments, will, I believe, want to hold together these issues. Ultimately, the control of climate change, ultimately, the welfare of the environment, is an issue of survival for everybody. It's not a question that can be addressed by one society alone, by one religious tradition alone, by one state alone. It's something that demands collaboration. But collaboration will only happen effectively when people trust one another to be working for each other's interests in the fullest and clearest way possible. So the challenge that faith communities in particular face at the moment is the challenge of holding up before our governments and our societies a clear moral vision. First of all, a moral vision which insists that we do justice to future generations. Secondly, a moral vision which insists that we do justice to all our fellow human beings on the globe at the moment. That we do justice by seeking welfare, peace and stability for poorer societies at the same time as we seek to control the great dangers that surround us environmentally. And because this will mean real challenges to developed and prosperous societies, real challenges to let go of some of their security and some of their prosperity, we should be under no illusion that this will be an easy task. We have to persuade people, and of course we have to persuade ourselves, that sacrifice is necessary and important, and at the end of the day, life-giving. And that surely is one of the perspectives that religious commitment can bring. Christianity talks about letting go of our lives in order to save them. And letting go of some of our obsession about security, prosperity, and success, in order that the whole world may live, in order that the whole human family may live and flourish, that is something which Christians ought to be underlining as strongly as they possibly can. So let me end by wishing every blessing and success to those involved in this meeting. When we meet to discuss these matters, we are reminded that we do have choices, that we can make a difference. I'm delighted to know that other faith leaders are stepping up to speak on this issue. I'm delighted to know that so many people want to be part of the decision-making of our governments on this crucial matter. So God bless and sustain you in that task.
Thank you, Archbishop Williams. We live in what just may be the beginning of a new world in which we all share the wisdom that life matters. Join us next week when we bring you the most important 15 minutes on Earth, the weekly Earth Summit. And now it's time to bring you up to date on the breaking nature news from around the nation and around the world. So now, the news. Unusual weather patterns continue as a series of storms rip across portions of the nation. Northern California was hit by severe rains and high winds that resulted in hundreds of thousands of Northern California residents left without power. As the severe weather reached into the Sierras, it dumped as much as 11 feet of snow on Kerwood, California, and tore down power lines for 500 miles. The unusual weather also was responsible for the breach of the Truckee Canal levee, which gave way to the ravaging waters produced by the storm. The town of Fernley, Nevada, was hit by massive flooding of up to 8 feet. Moving east, the specter of out-of-season weather phenomenon continues this winter as an unusual outbreak of tornadoes touched down in communities throughout Missouri, Wisconsin, and Illinois. The rash of tornadoes left many homes destroyed, cars thrown about, and derailed a locomotive and 12 freight cars. Throughout the region, residents are on guard against the specter of toxic spills and dangerous chemical contamination resulting from the spills. Residents in the east are experiencing unusually warm temperatures for early January, with highs in the 60s and above in much of the eastern states. In England, a decision is expected today on whether a new phase of nuclear power plants will be approved. Prime Minister Gordon Brown's spokesman announced, "It is expected that the plans for nuclear power expansion will be approved." The decision is riddled with controversy, as it would likely require a general rate hike to underwrite the massive investment in the new plants, which will not produce power until the year 2017. The British decision will be closely watched by other governments, many of which increasingly view nuclear power as an essential part of the energy mix into the future. Nuclear power does have the advantage that it does not emit carbon as a direct result of the production of energy. However, issues of the limited resources, the expanding mining, the disposal of nuclear waste, the level of investment and time frame from initiation to getting online do provide alternative views on its practicality. The Goodyear blimp may have about 8 years of flying left. Relying on helium to keep it afloat, it and all other industries which rely on helium may find the sources gone from planet Earth within the next 8 years. As with all elements, helium is a limited resource on the planet. It cannot be created. Once it is gone forever. Helium is used in many industrial processes and is particularly critical in superfreezing applications, which can include cooling in nuclear power plants and in research. The closest large-scale source of helium is located on the Sun. At this time, no plans are being made to make mining forays to old Helios. One of the newest technologies is application of old applications to our world. Recently, it was reported that ocean-going cargo vessels are being assisted by massive kites that help pull the ships across the oceans, cutting fuel consumption by 20%. Now we are hearing that Indian car company Tata will be introducing a unique air-powered car that runs on compressed air and emits zero pollutants. The car will be powered by an engine that runs from compressed air tanks, similar to those used in scuba diving. Designed by Frenchman Guy Negre, the former Formula One motor racing engineer's invention depends on pressurized air to move the pistons, which in turn help to compress the air again in a reservoir. The engine also has an electric motor, which needs to be periodically recharged to top up the air pressure. The car will travel at speeds of up to 93 miles per hour. Anyone who still believes that the clean tech revolution will not be able to develop fast enough to meet our needs for transference to renewable sources needs to have the air in their tires checked. And that's the news. We're making progress in a year of change. When we return, we head on out to the nation's capital to hear what Conservation International is doing to collaborate their efforts at saving and restoring the natural balance as they join hands with the poor and threatened to unite in faith to save the earth. Stay tuned.
Peace, 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 I can hear the bugle sounding, roaming around my land, my city and my town. Voices ringing louder while my bugle calls for peace.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Momentum. It has a force of its own. It's hard to create momentum, but once started, it's hard to stop it. It's taken 40 or so years to bring the Earth to a point where we are uniting our knowledge and now our forces to fix this planet. To keep it building, all it takes is for each of us to add our help. It's beginning to roll. It will involve us all. You'll see. In just a moment, we learn how faith-based communities are adding their spin to the emerging future when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. It's been interesting to see the change in what is now being referred to as the faith-based communities. In the U.S., the faith-based communities, often associated with the fundamentalist conservative Christian movement, found themselves allied with conservative politics, which has been increasingly undoing historic conservation principles in favor of corporate interests over the past 20 years. But as the pervasive effects of environmental degradation reach even into the small towns of Wyoming, Kentucky, Tennessee, Louisiana, typically strongholds of conservative Christian values, people from all faiths are seeing the wrong of the destruction of what is, to them, more than to many, God's creation. We continue to bring you this emerging story on the Wildside News, and today we add a fascinating new player in the global effort to restore the earth in partnership now with faith-based communities around the world. We're in 2008. It's a year of change. That certainly is being evidenced by what it seems as if the populace in their voting is saying these days, and everybody seems to want to get on that wagon, and you know what? That's a really good thing. And change is happening all over the planet, and it certainly is time. Change is happening in the environmental community as well. One of the areas that I find really fascinating is the emergence of the faith-based communities and the ways in which they have come to join the environmental effort for a lot of different reasons, and in many cases a very personal thing. One of the organizations that really is addressing this is one of my absolute all-time favorite conservation groups, and that is Conservation International, who work around the world, really work, to implement changes literally on the ground with communities and ecosystems. And joining us now from the nation's capital is Ben Campbell, who's the director of the Faith-Based Initiative for Conservation International. Ben, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
First of all, we always have new listeners. I'd like to invite you to give a brief overview of Conservation International and the work that you do.
Well, Conservation International is a 20-year-old organization. We just celebrated our 20th anniversary last year. And the way that we work is we've focused a lot of our priorities on what are called 34 hotspots, as well as wilderness areas and key biodiversity areas. The hotspot concept is an attractive one, in so much as it is a very small area of the Earth. Matter of fact, it represents 2.4% of the planet Earth itself. However, in it, it contains 60% of all biodiversity and 75% of all endangered species. So it allows us to prioritize our funding in a way that many other organizations can't. The other attractive feature of that is it is a hotspot primarily because it's been reduced to about 30% of its original habitat. Now, I say that because it also represents an area where there's a disproportionate number of the world's poor. So it is a hotspot in so many different ways. The fact that it also happens to be tropical could lead some to believe we chose it because of its tropical nature and being a hotspot because of that. But it is a wonderful opportunity that we are given to address both the areas that have the highest level of richness in terms of numbers of species, as well as the people who are most in need. And it is CI's mission to find ways which humans and conservation and biodiversity and all the richness that is this world can live together in harmony. And that's not the most articulate way of phrasing our mission statement, but it is more or less what we do.
Well, I appreciate the upfront work that you do to identify these very critical areas based on real science and many different factors, and then basically focus on that. I think it's just one of the most efficient and effective ways to really make a difference, and you are. And at another time, we'll be talking about that in depth. I always love to talk about Conservation International. You're heading up the Faith-Based Initiative, and that means many things to many different people. Why don't you tell us what you feel your mission is?
Well, the Faith-Based Initiative is more or less an acknowledgement that when you look at the people who are on the ground, many of them adhere to a very strong faith. I think the case was made for our CEO, Peter Seligman, in looking just at the Christians who happen to live in the areas where we consider them a priority for conservation purposes, and looking at the fact that we weren't reaching them from a core element of who they were. I mean, here in the West, we very commonly compartmentalize our beliefs with our activities, and especially because we live in a country like the United States that has a separation of church and state, we often think the rest of the world operates along a similar paradigm. The reality is, though, for many people, their faith, their religion, is part and parcel of how they view the world and how they act upon it. And unless we interpret how that plays into conservation, we're missing a key element of society. And more importantly, we have to acknowledge the role of religions in mobilizing their believers. Now, with the war on terror, we oftentimes look upon that in the negative sense, but we forget the very positive sense that religions have played an instrumental role in shaping our society. I mean, we watch films like Amazing Grace and are impressed by Wilberforce's strong role and his lifelong commitment to things like slavery and abolishing that heinous act of slavery.
I think it's very wise and fair and quite honestly progressive to take into consideration the human element, which is really where so many people live, embracing their faith or their spirituality, their religion, their relationship to the earth, and very often in remote parts of the world, it's truly very direct, their relationship with the earth. And so I applaud you for being intelligent and wise to really address that. And I'd be curious how it is that you then translate your mission into the field. How is it that you then take that message and help people in the various hot spots and other areas that you're focused on? How do you work in the field?
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, as you pointed out in your own description of us, we're a very science-led organization, and I am blessed, to use a faith-based term, to be able to sit in this office and be surrounded by some of the leading scientists in the conservation community. However, that is just one way of framing and understanding the issue. So what CI tries to do is it tries to make its science and economics and its policy and its years of experience in working with conservation much more acceptable to people on the ground. The way we do that is Conservation International works very closely with many of our partners. We have over 1,000 partners that work with us on the ground, most of these being local NGOs, national NGOs, and many other names I'm sure you'll recognize. In the case of the faith-based community, we look for leaders who are already interested in, or maybe at least open to talking to us, about how the religious faith relates to the environment. And we look for the ways of partnering with them. We don't claim to speak as experts in religious authority. I would never consider myself a theologian. I consider myself a believer, and in that sense, I can understand where the believers come from. And in that way, we look for people who are leaders and mobilizers of their own communities. And then we help them by helping them refine their alternatives and opportunities to work together. The best way of actually doing that is probably to give you just a couple examples of how we worked in the past. In Indonesia, we work with Islamic scholars to adapt what's called the Hima and Harim, which land and water management techniques that come out of the Hadith, which are, according to the World Conservation Union, the oldest land management system on the planet Earth. And what we've done is we recognize that these traditional land management techniques come out of a Middle Eastern society, and we worked with the Indonesian Islamic scholars to faithfully adapt those to an Indonesian context. Using what is a deeply ingrained belief of the Muslims in Indonesia, we've been able to pilot this program with schools, with a number of Muslim leaders and councils, and we've been working with them to use it as a way of protecting key watersheds and forests where the Indonesians live.
Indonesia is a very interesting part of the world where so much is happening. I know that one of your main areas of focus personally, because you are a forester, you're trained as a forester, you're a real science guy, and you work a lot with the forests, and that is a major topic on the planet right now. Tell us how conservation is working in that realm, particularly as it relates now to try to preserve and restore forests using the carbon markets, which a lot of people just don't grasp.
Conservation International is one of the lead agencies working on what's called the Climate Community and Biodiversity Alliance. What this is a group of agencies. It's conservation groups as well as industry players, commercial businesses. Weyerhaeuser, for example, is one of the organizations involved. Research institutions, the Hamburg Institute, for example, is involved. We have also some technical advice and guidance from many of the international research institutions like C4, which is the Center for International Forestry. They provide a lot of technical advice on how to do this. We've also been able to bring many of the development groups on board. Right now, CARE is a member of the CCBA. And the hopes of this is acknowledging the fact that the carbon markets are growing. We want to ensure that it's not just focused exclusively on a strategy that is concerned about climate and emissions. Because I think we'll miss an opportunity to get multiple benefits out of those markets. And I say that because, I mean, many people are focused on climate change as a key topic and is very important, and that's not to underestimate our need to respond. However, the decisions we make now are critical because they'll have ramifications not just for us, but for our children and for the poor of the world. The CCBA, the Climate Community and Biodiversity Alliance, is an attempt to broaden that, to make sure that any work we do in the carbon offset markets also benefits the community in terms of poverty alleviation, but also helps to maintain and rebuild critical ecosystems for biodiversity. So by the capturing of this one market, this carbon offset market, we're hoping to gain multiple benefits out of it. And the CCBA has set up a series of standards that have key criteria and indicators that anybody who wants to apply this methodology in a forest-based carbon offset market can do so at the program level and do it in a way that makes sure that any project has all three key elements. One, it reduces emissions through avoiding deforestation and also replanting of trees that absorb carbon through their evaporation and transpiration. Two, that the communities are actively involved in the program and can see a real benefit from it. And that's a key thing, that they're actually benefiting. Otherwise, you could have a climate program that basically planted fast-growing non-native species, kicking people off their land because it might be economically profitable to do so, and growing whatever. But the community doesn't benefit except for a few jobs. And then finally, a key to Conservation International as well is that we work to try to rehabilitate and to maintain these key ecosystems and all the benefits that come from those. Not just the woolly and fully species that we like to protect, but also all the key things that come from a good, healthy ecosystem. Its ability to withstand storms, its ability to provide a key watershed and water for people who live downstream from it, the ability to provide fruit, fiber, food for people who live much closer to nature than those of us who happen to shop at Whole Foods. All these things come into play so that in one program you get all these benefits at once. And to make sure that you're measuring it and holding yourself accountable as well while you're implementing these programs.
So many people are really trying to do the right thing. But as you say, unfortunately, in the effort of trying to do this the right thing from the great big industrialized countries, we may be insensitive to these people who maybe their entire forest ecology begins to be changed from a kind of a natural sustainable community to a monoculture crop to support fast-growing trees that will help to diminish the carbon footprint in the planet.
We very much want to make sure that much of what is done now in addressing climate change is done to ensure that everyone benefits from it. Yes, climate change is taking place. Yes, the worst-case scenarios sound incredibly dire. But at the same time, I think we can seize upon an opportunity and we can harness the markets to do it, to try to build a much more just and equitable system. One of the things that CI has oftentimes prided itself on is to work to establish new models of doing things. And we don't claim to do it all ourselves. I mean, the problems are so big that an organization even like CI cannot do it all itself. What we hope to do is demonstrate ways of which things can be done and to find good partners who are willing to try and experiment and to develop these things so that we can frame policy and we can frame models for the future that others can lock onto. We'll make the investment. We'll make the mistakes. And we'll admit those have been made in the past. But it's very important that at this initial outset that we be daring and be bold and to try to address this as much as possible to find very effective ways to benefit the poor, which we all claim we're concerned about. I mean, from a religious standpoint myself, we all talk about the key aspects of social justice and how the poor will suffer the first and primary ramifications of climate change, while at the same time they themselves are not responsible for the historical emissions that are causing the problem in the first place. And then at the same time, we are losing biodiversity at a phenomenal rate. The current extinction levels are anywhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times what they should be. And I think we bear responsibility to that in this current generation to try to develop solutions that address both poverty, and if that's not addressed, or you can forget anything else we do in terms of conservation, because people looking out for their own livelihoods will grasp the immediacy of their needs and not be able to invest in the future. And so if we want to leave them a planet that is socially just, fair to the poor, and still has a wonderful array of species on it, both for our benefit and for the greater benefit of the planet itself, then we need to define ways of doing things and models for doing things that are effective and fair and balanced.
Now, the challenge is getting your message out, and I'm just curious how it is that you're getting your efforts out to the world. How can people learn more about this? What can they do? What could they be reading, for example, or paying attention to be sure that they're following what CI is doing?
Well, this program is one of them, so I thank you very much for the opportunity to do it.
Anytime.
And also, we have a lot of information out there. Conservation International has a lot of good websites that are linked to our primary website, www.conservation.org, and you can see much of the work that CI is doing. We have a cadre of excellent scientists in our Center for Applied Biodiversity Science, and they work down the hall from me, and they are very much looking at and leading the cutting edge of science to address this issue. We have the Center for Environmental Leadership and Business, which is an attempt to leverage the role and responsibility of businesses in preserving this planet for the future and working with them to develop standards and market-based approaches to conservation. And so they can play a role. So it's that social responsible, triple bottom line approach to doing business. And then we like to think that our Center for Environmental Leadership in business is not averse to taking on the very large corporations, the ones that have a lot of purchasing power, and demonstrating that if they can do it, anybody can do it.
It's so fascinating to think of the coalition that is forming around this effort to do the right thing at this time, particularly as it reaches around the world. Within the United States itself, are churches becoming involved?
Very much so. I think you're seeing the growing awareness of what we're facing, not just for climate change, but species loss in general. And very quickly, we're breaking down these silos in between what's an environmental issue, what's a poverty issue, what's social justice. And I think there's a lot of learning that has to go on with that. But we can seize the opportunity to learn from that and really take a much more comprehensive approach to dealing with these issues. The unfortunate thing is we've always treated certain issues as, oh, those are environmental issues. So why are we worried about that? We're for economic growth, or we're for development, or we're for humanitarian relief. And I come from many of those different areas of work. And for me, I see the interrelatedness of all of them. They're interlinked. You cannot deal with one without dealing with the other one. And so it's very important to seize this opportunity to make the connection and to realize some of these things are not just environmental issues. Climate change is not an environmental issue. It speaks to the type of planet we want to leave for our children. And nor is things like species loss or degradation of ecosystems. It's easy to treat them as environmental issues because the environmentalists have been the ones raising the alarm about them. But increasingly, this is an issue that relates to all of us. Now, the importance of involving the religious community is that they can bring their moral authority to the task. Much like the example I used of Wilberforce, much like the example of our own civil rights movement, much like the example of apartheid in South Africa, it was the faith community that has the wherewithal and the ability to see the long-term perspective and to dedicate themselves. It is very hard, and I'll admit this, I live and work in Washington, D.C. I can just take a look at this big dome building and see the difficulties it is for a political person to make a commitment that will render benefits in the next 10 years, next 20 years, next 50 years, the time period for our children and our grandchildren, when they're worried about the next election in 2 years, 4 years, or 6 years' time. And so, in a similar way, our companies themselves are faced with issues of the next quarter, next fiscal year. It's hard for them to think in terms of those longer schemes of things. Fortunately, you have progressive people both in the Congress and the Senate, progressive people in businesses that are thinking those terms and can provide an example to the rest of us. The advantage of the faith community is it's always thought in long-term times. It's always been able to voice its moral authority and bring that moral authority based on their own sacred writings, whether they be the Christian's Holy Bible or the Muslim's Holy Quran. And it is that longer-term perspective that can oftentimes, in my opinion, trump some of the political arguments and some of the economic arguments, because they can make us sit back and think, what is the socially just thing to do?
We look to a world of peace and sustainability. That is really what we need to work for as much as we can. The vision of a happy people around the world, living in balance with their environment, living in balance with each other, is truly the basis and the foundation of what I would consider to be faith-based concepts. We must create as much as we can. Fairness, justice, sustainability, and peace. Ben Campbell, director of the Faith-Based Initiative with Conservation International, I want to thank you and invite you to tell people how they can find out more about your work.
Well, for one thing, it is on our website, and please do check that out. We work with a number of partners, and I'd love to be able to credit all of them for their excellent work, but you can find their links on our webpage as well. And I'd like to point out, it's something that CI doesn't do itself. We are very much a partnering organization. If you have a good idea and work in one of our hotspots or work in an environmental issue, we'd be very happy and willing to talk to you.
Ben Campbell, Director of Faith-Based Initiative with Conservation International, thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wildside News.
Thank you.
In all fairness, we could talk with Ben Campbell for another 4 hours. He is a man of extraordinary depth and devotion to the earth, the people of the earth, and our future. I look forward to talking with Ben Campbell throughout the years ahead. Thank God we were provided with vision and the wisdom to use it. Turn out the light as we head into our new world. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, each Tuesday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth sings out around the world, here on the Wildside News.